The mayor of New Orleans says his police department may be the worst in the country. There are 8 current federal criminal investigations of the department, including several cases where police killed civilians. And the details are, they're horrific. In the Danziger Bridge case, which we talked about last week, a mentally handicapped man was shot in the back of the head and then police stomped on his body. In the Glover case, a man was killed and his body was torched inside his car. For some New Orleanians, the revelations support their long-held belief that the police cannot be trusted. And the corruption runs so deep, it travels so far back in history, many people there say it cannot get better. So we're joined now by Robert Goodman, a community organizer who works with victims of police abuse. Also with us, John Wolfe from the Vera Institute of Justice. That's an organization that's trying to reform the way the police deals with citizens, not just in New Orleans. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Robert, your work with the community started with your own personal story. Tell us what happened to your brother.
On May the 9th, 2006, my mother was trying to get my brother into a mental facility because due to Katrina, most of the mental facilities had broke down, and he had been off his medicine a while. So we went to the colonel to get admit papers. The police showed up. They claimed they heard a gunfire. So several hours later, a lot of gunfire went off, shooting at the house, which at that time they was in the house, and they shot my brother at least one time at that time. Witness said they heard him, police saying over the radio, because they had him standing by my family at the time, that he's weeping for his mother. He's weeping for his mama. And then a couple hours later, they shot tear gas in, which I thought was just a diversion to finish him off, and shot him in the head twice after that. And he died after that. And according to the police report, you know, they said they found him on the floor where there was no blood showing, because I filmed everything afterwards, and all the blood was in the bed, and he was handcuffed. And,
Robert, you know, since the tragedy with your brother, which, you know, obviously is a terribly traumatic experience, you've then reached out to other community members to try who have been victims, you say, of police abuse. And I was struck by some of the stories that you tell of strategies that people have to try to stay out of trouble, to try and keep themselves from getting shot by police officers. Can you tell me what some of the people of New Orleans do?
Well, again, I work for an organization called Safety Strong Community, and we normally reach out to families of victims who've been killed by NOPD or police brutality. As you were speaking earlier about the Danziger Bridge, the Madison family, who Ronald Madison was shot, and I just need to correct that. He was shot in the shoulder first, and then he was shot in the back 5 times.
But what you were talking with one of our producers earlier about some of the things that people have now done, strategies that they use, for such as mothers advising their sons not to put their registration in their glove department so the police won't think they're reaching for a gun.
I've spoken to several mothers, and because of their fear of NOPD, a couple of ladies said they advised their sons to keep their registration and everything up on their visor, their sun visor, so in case the police stop and ask them for their registration, because they fear that if they have to go into their glove compartment, they may use that as an excuse saying they're coming out with a gun and kill them. So a lot of mothers, and we talking about kids not in the streets, so we talking about, you know, kids going to college and school and things like that, but because the way they dress, they link them to street gangs or whatever. Not say gangs, we don't have gangs in New Orleans, but as they won't call them thugs and things like that. So a lot of mothers live in fear because of that.
Well, John Wool, let me bring you into this conversation. John Wool of the Vera Institute of Justice. Hearing these stories, and I'm sure you've heard lots of them in your work in New Orleans, how on earth can you bridge this gap between the New Orleans Police Department and the community that it serves, is supposed to serve and protect?
Well, one has to do so slowly and deliberately over, and recognize that it's going to take quite a long period of time to make progress in healing these relations, because Robert is not understating the depth of the of the problem. I think the most hopeful sign right now is that the new mayoral administration and the new superintendent of police also are not understating the scope of the problem. And I think most importantly, perhaps, they are recognizing that the burden for beginning the healing is on them, not on the community. I mean, I think there's very much that the community can do to help the department rebuild itself and rebuild its image, but the burden is indeed on the department, and they are meeting that burden to this point, and it's only been 2.5 months since the new mayor took over and a little less since the new superintendent, but they are taking positive steps to reinvent themselves.
We're talking about, you know, upstanding, stable families who say they would rather deal with a burglar themselves than ever call the police. Robert, and it's not just New Orleans. New Orleans is obviously a particularly striking example, but there's reports of distrust in Detroit, where they have federal oversight. In Phoenix, we have words of the police officers there. Obviously, in Los Angeles, they'd had trouble with this. In Washington, D.C., what is it with our urban police departments that makes it particularly difficult to maintain a good relationship between the communities they serve and the police?
Well, first of all, like you said, it's a distrust, and because of the disrespect, you know, they can come up on the scene and neighbors may come out to watch to see what's going on, and they are using vile language to elderly people, to run them inside, just total disrespect, you know. And you would think with the DOJ and the feds being, you know, investigating all these police situations, just last week a good friend of mine got his jaw broke from the police, handcuffed him and then knocked his feet from under him and his face hit the ground. So, you know, it's still a lot of that going on, and it's those two people that they're going to have to weave out, and maybe at some point they can build some trust. But like John said earlier, it starts with the police department to try to win the community over.
John, do you think we need just a transformation of our strategies in our urban areas?
Yeah, I do, and I think that's essentially what Vera is trying to do, not just with the police department, but with all of the criminal justice actors. There are many ways that cities can maintain public safety without the heavy-handed types of enforcement and the high reliance on enforcement, and not just police enforcement, but the incarceration that follows it. There are many ways that cities have developed to get the job done, but get it done in a way that's respectful, that's doesn't use all of the might of government in every case, particularly low-level cases. And there are many, many cases in New Orleans. This is a very enforcement-heavy system. So most hopeful, right, I think, is the department's willingness
to change,
to work with us, to try. Well, one example
and
is
when
to
you
move
say us,
to
you're talking about the Vera Institute of Justice. That's who John Wool is the director of. Robert Goodman is a community organizer with Safe Streets, Strong Communities in New Orleans. Thanks so much to both of you. And let us know, give us a report from your own community and tell us what's the relationship there between the police and your community. That's 8778-MY-TAKE.
Well, for those of you who are wondering where John is, he is on vacation, but he's also prepping for next week. It's the 20th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. He's going to be the keynote in Boston at a big event on Monday, and if you want some information on how to attend, head to our blog, thetakeaway.org/blogs. In the meantime, I'm filling in for him. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.